Okay, now we are finally to the part in the term where we will concentrate on specific pathways. And it makes sense to start with the pathway we're starting with, which is glycolysis. Because, well, a couple reasons. One is that you've studied it at least in some detail before. But more importantly, it's the central metabolic pathway. Central because, not only meaning important, but central in terms of how many things connect to it, how many other pathways connect to glycolysis. So you might be thinking in terms of glycolysis having the purpose of breaking glucose down into pyruvate, which of course it does, but that is just actually one of its functions. Because of its connection with other pathways, it can actually do the part of several other processes. But it's also important simply because glucose is the predominant carbohydrate, it's the predominant monosaccharide in cells in general, not just in your cells, but in all cells. And it's also the predominant fuel in virtually all cells, not just your own cells, but just about every living cell uses glucose as a primary fuel. So glycolysis is not only a central pathway within a cell, any given cell, it's also a ubiquitous pathway because all cells are capable of doing this. It's an ancient pathway. Been around for a long time in cells. Glycolysis, of course, is named for the fact that sugar gets split. The glyke part of the word refers to sugar, specifically glucose, and lysis means splitting. And so glycolysis is, even though it's a pathway unto itself, it's a 10-step pathway just for glycolysis, it is just the first part of the overall catabolism of glucose. If you think about catabolizing glucose as a fuel, you're doing that for the purpose of harvesting energy from that fuel, for the purpose of capturing the usable part of that harvested energy to store temporarily in the form of activated carrier molecules, specifically ATP molecules. It makes sense to do that to get as much energy as possible out of that fuel. Well, some energy is gotten out of the glucose by glycolysis, but not nearly all of it. So the end point of glycolysis, which is the pyruvate molecules that are produced from glycolysis, they are only partially spent fuel molecules. They're still valuable fuel molecules in their own right. And that's why, under certain circumstances, in certain kinds of cells, that pyruvate will be used as a fuel molecule itself, and much more energy can be extracted from what was originally glucose. So, glycolysis is a splitting of glucose, and in terms of the carbon skeleton, it's an even splitting, meaning that you start out with a hexose. Glucose is a hexose, a six-carbon skeleton. That gets partially dismantled by glycolysis, which is why by the end you are left with 2 3-carbon compounds. Each pyruvate that's produced, 2 for every glucose, is a 3-carbon compound. So you end up having the same number of carbons, of course. No matter is destroyed in the process. You're just dismantling the carbon skeleton, and in the process, getting some energy out of that bigger molecule by catabolizing it into smaller molecules. The overall glycolytic pathway, which is just another way of saying glycolysis, can be thought of as occurring in 2 phases. It's 10 steps in terms of individual chemical reactions, But you can think of it importantly as having two phases, two major phases. A so-called energy investment phase and a so-called energy payoff phase. So this makes sense in terms of energy because this is all part of energy metabolism. The energy investment phase, as the name implies, is stage one that's shown on this slide one. But it's, as the name implies, it is a stage that actually requires an input of energy for it to proceed. The first part you have to force to happen by spending some ATP, even though the goal, in a sense, is to make ATP from this glucose. You're going to have to spend some ATP in this first stage, the energy investment stage, in order for it to work. But it's worth it because in the energy payoff phase, stage two, you end up making more ATP than you spend in the first stage, so it's a net profit. All right, so we're going to study this in terms of a single molecule entering, one glucose. And for the first stage, until we get to the very end, the bottom of this figure, we stay at just one molecule. Because in this energy investment phase, what's happening beyond the spending of energy, which is spent in terms of ATP being losing its phosphates, right? Well, where do those phosphates go? On to the fuel itself. So two ATP are spent in this first stage, as you notice the two curved arrows here. Two ATPs are dephosphorylated into ADP. That phosphate that's liberated from the hydrolysis of ATP gets hooked on to the fuel molecule, whatever that fuel molecule is at the time. The first one to get phosphorylated is glucose itself. And so the first step is the transformation of glucose into glucose 6-phosphate, as you see. That is important for locking the fuel into the cell. If you think about what is happening in your own body, the glucose that comes into your body because you have digested some sugar, which the digestion breaks it down into monosaccharides, that then enters your body because that's a small enough molecule to enter the cells of your body through your gut lining. Once that's in the blood, well, the blood is actually extracellular, right? It's an extracellular fluid. For that glucose to get into any cell that's going to have to use it as fuel, it needs to go through a plasma membrane of that cell. And it does so passively in terms of energy. It will diffuse into cells, but not directly through the phospholipid bilayer. In other words, it needs the help of a transport protein. So glucose molecules get transported through a glucose transporter in a given cell. Now it's inside the cell. And as soon as it's inside the cell, it gets phosphorylated by spending an ATP to do that. When you phosphorylate the glucose, what you have is no longer ordinary glucose. You have glucose 6-phosphate. That activates the fuel because we're sticking two phosphates on so that the fuel will have phosphoryl transfer potential like we were talking about last time. So that's one reason that this first ATP is spent. But also importantly, by transforming it into glucose 6-phosphate, which is no longer the same chemical as glucose, that means you're not letting glucose accumulate in the cell. So that means it maintains a gradient. It's going to maintain a low concentration in the cell so that it will still be coming in from the blood by diffusion down its gradient. You understand what I'm saying there? Okay, so that's one important reason for this first phosphorylation. The rest of stage one, though, is really just rearranging this 6-carbon sugar into isomers, and then adding another phosphate along the way until you get to this fork in the road within glycolysis itself. Now, there's another important fork in the road at the end of glycolysis that we've already talked about and will again. But this, the end of the energy investment phase, the bottom of this slide, is actually a kind of a fork as well. That's where the splitting occurs. That's where the lysis of glycolysis occurs, because this is where you go from a 6-carbon compound to a 3-carbon compound. Okay, well, that's actually 2 3-carbon compounds, I should say. Also notice that the arrows, which indicate the actual individual chemical reaction in each step, some of them are double arrows, meaning that these are reversible reactions. And as if we look at the overall pathway, most of them are reversible reactions. But there are a few that are essentially irreversible. They go almost entirely one way, including the first one and this one right here that's catalyzed by phosphofructokinase. That's important because irreversible steps in a pathway are the steps that are going to serve as control points. It's important to control glycolysis, not just let it happen all the time, but turn it on or off when appropriate. That's going to happen by controlling the enzymes that are in charge of the irreversible reactions. And that first one is an example of that. So it is a control point, but it's not as important a control point as this one down here catalyzed by phosphofructokinase. That is the main control point of glycolysis, as we'll talk more about later. But it makes sense that that's the main control point, because in any given pathway, the main control point is going to be the first committed step of the pathway. Not necessarily the very first step, the first committed step. The committed step is the first step that is only involved in that pathway. The first couple steps are actually connected to other pathways as well, so they are not just the sole property of glycolysis, in a sense. But this reaction is just for glycolysis. It's not connected to other processes. So this is the committed step of glycolysis, and that's the main control point. It's an irreversible reaction, and at these control points, what kind of enzymes do you expect to be operating? Allosteric enzymes, exactly. Okay. On the bottom, I said that's kind of a fork in the road. What's happening here is that when this 6-carbon sugar that is doubly phosphorylated, which is why it's called fructose 1,6-bisphosphate, when it gets split and you now have 2 3-carbon compounds, it gets split into dihydroxyacetone phosphate and glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate. Those aren't identical, but they have the same chemical formulae. They're isomers, in other words. Well, glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate is the only one of these two sugars that's made that can go on to stage 2. But they're both made because one is one half and the other is the other half of what started out as this fructose 1,6-bisphosphate. So that would be wasteful if you could only use one of these 3-carbon compounds for the rest of the process, right? You would be wasting half of the fuel at this point. And that's why it's important to have an enzyme that will isomerize, or convert one isomer into the other. It will isomerize dihydroxyacetone phosphate, the one that can't go on in the pathway, to the one that can, glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate. So even though it happens this way, the end result is that for every glucose that comes into glycolysis, you end up making 2 glyceraldehyde 3-phosphates, one directly and one indirectly. And then they both go on to stage 2 individually. And that's why it's important to keep in mind that when you study stage 2, the energy payoff phase, you have to multiply everything by 2 in terms of what's required and what's spit out. because there are going to be two of these G3Ps, or glyceraldehyde 3-phosphates, entering that second stage. All right, let's go to the second stage then in slide two. So just the end part of stage one is shown on the top. That's the glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate. Three carbon sugar, as you see on the formulae to the right. And it is phosphorylated. Let me back up for just a second. Remember I said that fructose 1,6-bisphosphate is doubly phosphorylated? When you split this thing into two, each three-carbon compound has one phosphate on it. So each one is an activated sugar when you go into stage two. The energy payoff phase is self-explanatory. You get ATP back in greater abundance than you paid off in the first stage. So there's only two ATPs being produced here. You spent two, but keep in mind that this is happening twice because you have two glyceraldehyde 3-phosphates entering the second stage. So when you multiply everything in yellow by two, you're actually earning four. I mean, you're spitting out four ATPs for every glucose, but you've already spent two for that glucose in the first stage. So the payoff is a net of two ATPs earned. That's not the only payoff, though. Notice in the first reaction of the payoff phase, the top of this slide, that the transformation of glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate into 1,3-bisphosphoglycerate is a redox reaction that reduces NAD plus into NADH. So never lose track of the fact that when you are reducing coenzymes, storing energy that was in the fuel. Just like when you make ATP, you're doing that. Well, when you make NADH, you're actually storing even more energy than an ATP molecule is storing. And in the final payoff, assuming that we go to cellular respiration all the way through the catabolism of glucose, then every NADH that you've produced along the way is going to pay off in multiple ATPs. So it's valuable energy that was in the glucose originally. All right, so that's the main gist of the two phases. Let's look at the details now. One step at a time. The first part in slide three is when glucose first comes into the cell. Like I said, it needs to be phosphorylated not only to activate it in terms of phosphoryl transfer potential, but also just to turn it into something else so that the concentration of glucose remains low and keeps the gradient steep so that you can continue to import it through the glucose transporters. And that is done, as you see, by an enzyme with the name hexokinase. Now, what are kinases in general? They are enzymes whose job it is to phosphorylate something. And this is a perfect name for it. It's hexokinase because glucose is a hexose. Actually, hexokinase is able to phosphorylate other hexoses as well, which is why it's not just called glucokinase. All right. There is one called glucokinase operating in the liver, but this is a more general one throughout the body. Hexokinase takes a phosphoryl group off of ATP, which is why you're spending it here in the process, and transfers it to the sugar itself. And so we call this glucose-6-phosphate simply because the phosphoryl group is now on the group of atoms associated with carbon 6. This is carbon 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. It's glucose-6-phosphate. You've spent the energy of ATP, so you now have an ADP. Okay, let's go to 4 and look at a space-filling model of hexokinase. And what you see happening here is something we've already talked about. Notice the shape is changing from left to right. The left version is the unbound enzyme. But when the substrates come along, glucose and ADP, I mean ATP, what happens is a conformational change, right? What do we call that? Conformational change of an enzyme in response to substrate binding? Induced fit. Not only gives a better fit, but it makes sure the correct chemistry goes on. In this case, that induced fit excludes water molecules that would otherwise interfere. Water molecules could get in there and actually hydrolyze the ATP just into water. I mean, into ADP and inorganic phosphate rather than sticking it onto the sugar. That would be a waste of energy. So the induced fit is important here. That's the point of the slide. All right, so now we already have produced glucose-6-phosphate. Slide 5 shows you the next step. Glucose-6-phosphate in ring form is shown on the left. Notice that there is a somewhat reversible reaction between the ring form and the open chain form. But notice that the ring form is actually favored here, longer arrow here. You need to go to the open chain form, though, for the isomerization to work. And that's what's happening here. You're starting with glucose-6-phosphate. You need to get to fructose-6-phosphate because fructose-6-phosphate is what you need in order to stick that additional phosphate onto it. Okay? The difference is glucose is an aldose. Fructose is a ketose, right? You need to have it in a ketone form in order to stick that additional phosphate onto it. So that's just a matter of rearranging the carbon skeleton, which is why it's an isomerization. Well, you need to go through from ring form to open chain form of glucose and then isomerize it into fructose. Notice that what's happening is you're shifting the carbonyl group from the terminal carbon to a non-terminal carbon, which is why you're going from an aldose to a ketose. That's highly reversible. And then there's a mostly reversible reaction that favors formation of fructose-6-phosphate. Well, as long as you have something using up fructose-6-phosphate continuously, that's going to shift everything to the right. And that, in other words, you're going to keep glucose-6-phosphate itself fairly rare in the cell, low concentration, and that's going to shift the equilibrium, right? That's an example of what principle in chemistry? Le Chatelier's principle, exactly. You take away a reactant, that's going to shift, the reaction is going to respond by creating more product to minimize the change that you've induced in the system. And that's important in biochemical pathways in general. It's what keeps them operating a lot of times. The enzyme isn't shown here. Does anyone remember what it is? What's happening here is that we're turning glucose-6-phosphate, which is a phosphorylated hexose, into another phosphorylated hexose, so it's just an isomerization. And we're specifically changing glucose-6-phosphate. Therefore, the enzyme, well, you could have named it several different things, but it was named phosphoglucose isomerase because you're starting with a phosphorylated glucose and you're isomerizing it into fructose-6-phosphate. Okay, now we are in slide 6 to the most important control point that I was talking about, but we'll talk more about the control later. The point here in terms of progress through the pathway is that we need to transform fructose-6-phosphate into a doubly phosphorylated compound. The reason we needed to get it into the ketone form, fructose, was so that we had a place to stick this extra phosphate. It's more symmetrical, a molecule with two carbons hanging off of the chain, each of which can be phosphorylated. Well, we already have a phosphoryl group on one of these carbons hanging off the chain, which is why it's fructose-6-phosphate to begin with, we're just going to add another phosphate to the other carbon hanging off of the chain. And that's why the product is called fructose-1,6-bisphosphate. Now, bis means two, but so does di. They're not, though, interchangeable. They, even though they both mean two, they mean two in different ways. Bis is used to indicate a compound whose two phosphates are individually stuck on different places of that molecule, as you see here. On the other hand, in ADP, which is adenosine diphosphate, in that case, it's two phosphates hooked to each other, and then that one double phosphate unit is connected to one place on the molecule. That's why we use di in that situation. Okay? So we have fructose-1,6-bisphosphate, a doubly phosphorylated hexose that can now be split apart into two singly phosphorylated trioses. That's the lysis part of glycolysis that's going to happen next. Does that make sense? Everyone good? All right. Let's go to that next step, slide 7. Fructose-1,6-bisphosphate on the left, we just made that, shown in open chain form here. And when it's split apart, you now have two three-carbon compounds that are not identical, but they're isomers of each other, as I said in that opening slide. One of them is dihydroxyacetone phosphate, DHAP. The other is glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate, which this book abbreviates as GAP. Some books do that. Other books use G3P. It actually has 5 different abbreviations it can go by or so, which is kind of ridiculous because it's hard enough keeping track of all the acronyms, but G3P is what I usually use. Anyway, G3P and GAP mean exactly the same thing. The enzyme that does this is called aldolase because what we're starting with, because aldol, that combining form, aldol is really short for aldehyde alcohol. Okay? So that's what's actually involved here. An aldehyde, of course, has a terminal carbonyl. Glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate is an aldehyde alcohol. So aldolase makes both of these, even though I said only one of these can then go on. It's glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate is the one that can go on to stage 2, which is why we need to take the dihydroxyacetone phosphate that's also produced and turn it into glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate, which is what's shown in slide 8. So this is the end of stage 1. Dihydroxyacetone phosphate, which would otherwise be worthless, gets isomerized itself into glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate, and that's why the enzyme is called an isomerase. And it makes sense to specifically call it triose phosphate isomerase because the two isomers of each other are both triose phosphates, right? They're 3-carbon sugars with a phosphate connected to them. You're just changing where that carbonyl group is. You're turning this ketone into an aldehyde. Okay, 9. Now you have to keep in mind that we have two separate glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate molecules for the single glucose that we started out with. This is the beginning of stage 2. We're going to look at it in terms of glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate being alone, but you have to double everything in your mind. All right? So the first step is already a payoff. This is the energy payoff phase, and we already get some payoff because what's happening in this first step is transformation of glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate into 1,3-bisphosphoglycerate. That is going to extract some energy from the fuel molecule, G3P, and store some of it in the form of reduced coenzyme. NADH gets produced out of NAD+. The inorganic phosphate that's on the left side here ends up on the fuel molecule. So that's why they're different colors. The magenta inorganic phosphate gets stuck onto there. And so now we have a doubly phosphorylated triose. And we also have another one just like it because you have to multiply everything by two. Okay, so this is why we're spitting out two NADHs. And that is important because each of those NADHs has enough energy that it's carrying. If it's allowed to dump it off to an electron transport chain, to pay off in terms of multiple ATPs. Okay. Oh, glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate dehydrogenase. Good name, good descriptive name, right? It's named for the substrate, but also for its function. This is a dehydrogenation reaction. Dehydrogenation reactions are an important part of fuel catabolism. That's how you claim the energy from that fuel in a lot of cases, by picking hydrogens off of that carbon skeleton. All right. So dehydrogenation is a specific kind of oxidation, because when you pick a hydrogen atom off of a carbon skeleton, you're removing electrons. You're removing a proton along with the electron when you take off an entire hydrogen. But because you're removing electrons, that's oxidation. And it's not the only way that oxidation happens, but it is oxidation. The steps in which energy gets released, whether it's by dehydrogenation or not, is because carbons somewhere in the fuel are becoming oxidized, like we were talking about in terms of the methane and then going through the steps all the way to carbon dioxide. Okay, now in 10, we see this same reaction, but let me just indicate that if you look at the chemical formulae, glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate looks like that. 1,3-bisphosphoglycerate looks like that. We're showing this in one step, but really it involves two processes that you see both of on slide 10. The first process is the oxidation part, which is what reduces NAD+ into NADH. The carbon up here gets oxidized because now it's involved with another oxygen as well, so it's partially losing its electrons. Okay, that's where the energy comes out of the fuel. Well, that makes an intermediate, and which is glyceraldehyde phosphate right here. That then needs to undergo a dehydration reaction to receive the phosphate. So what the previous slide showed is happening as just one step is actually two steps that happen at the same time with the help of the same enzyme. All right? It's an oxidation and a dehydration. If those were to happen just one after the other as independent reactions, then you would come to a dead end. That's what slide 11 is trying to explain here in terms of these energy graphs. On the left, part A, we have the situation that would occur if the first step, the oxidation step, happened, and then you had to undergo the dehydration reaction. The oxidation step is highly exergonic, so it's this half of graph A, the left half. Highly exergonic, right? A lot of energy is released. The problem is the dehydration step that's next is highly endergonic to get to the final product. And so if you just happened in steps, you'd be stuck down here in the bottom of this valley. You wouldn't have the ability to get up here. And so glycolysis would come to a halt. It doesn't in reality, though, because the enzyme forms an intermediate, connects that intermediate to itself via a sulfhydryl group that's part of the active site. So what kind of residue do you suppose is involved? A cysteine, yeah. It would be an SH normally if it's unbound, but the H gets replaced by this intermediate. And so that's called a thioester intermediate because this is very much like an ester bond except involving a sulfur, so it's thioester. That's what basically keeps this thing from dipping down energetically into this valley. So if you notice the G level here originally, it's slightly higher than the final G, which means overall it's spontaneous. Well, it is over here too, except you get stuck down in this pit. By involving this thioester intermediate, the valley here is slightly lower than the first G, but still slightly higher than the final G. So both of these steps are therefore spontaneous in this way. And what the enzyme has accomplished, as usual, is a severe reduction in activation energy, which this book symbolizes as delta G double dagger. E sub A is really what this height is, right? Okay. Let's go to 12 now. So that is another phosphorylation reaction that we just did because we've stuck another phosphate onto the 3-carbon fuel, and which is why we now call it 1,3-bisphosphoglycerate. There's a phosphate on carbon 1 and on carbon 3. That then is going to undergo dephosphorylation. So the whole reason that we wanted to get that phosphate onto that 3-carbon fuel in the previous step was because that 3-carbon fuel now has high phosphoryl transfer potential, meaning that it's willing to give it up to something else. And that thing that it is going to receive that phosphate from the fuel is an ADP molecule, which is why when you phosphorylate the ADP, you produce ATP, which is the goal of all of this, right? To get ATP from the energy that was stored in the original glucose. So this is part of the payoff as well. The NADH is an important part of the payoff. It's just not in its final form yet. It's carrying energy around that will later be transformed will be used to make more ATP. But this ATP is the end goal, if you want to think about it in terms of goals. All right. But that still leaves a phosphate on the fuel, which is why the fuel is called just 3-phosphoglycerate. Oh, and phosphoglycerate kinase. Well, this is an example. Sometimes these reversible reactions are named for the enzyme that catalyzes them are named for the other direction. Remember, these things, these reversible reactions can happen in either direction. Phosphoglycerate kinase is really named for the fact that if you run this in reverse, you can take 3-phosphoglycerate, add a phosphate to it, which is what a kinase does, and make the left side, 1,3-bisphosphoglycerate. But in this case, in terms of glycolysis progression, we're actually running this from left to right. The enzyme is named, though, for the right-to-left action. Everyone see what I'm saying there? Okay. Well, in 13, we're finishing up glycolysis here. But there's a few steps here and therefore a few enzymes involved. So the 3-phosphoglycerate that we just made, a singly phosphorylated triose, which is valuable fuel, it is valuable fuel in terms of the fact that there's a phosphate on it still, which can be passed on to an ADP in order to make ATP. But not in its present form can that be done. So another isomerization needs to take place, namely from 3-phosphoglycerate to 2-phosphoglycerate. All that's happening here is that the phosphoryl group, which is associated with the 3rd carbon, is getting stuck onto the group that's associated with the 2nd carbon. So it's, yes, it is an isomerization, and they could have called the enzyme an isomerase. It is acting as an isomerase. But some isomerases we give an even more specific name, mutases, when all that's really happening is that a functional group gets moved from one position to another. And that's exactly what's happening here, which is why it's called phosphoglycerate mutase. Now we have 2-phosphoglycerate, and we need to get it into a form that's unstable, more highly unstable, so that it will be more willing to give up its phosphate. By being unstable, that's another way of saying that it has high phosphoryl transfer potential, because it will gain stability by losing that phosphoryl group. And that's what we want it to do, because we want it to lose it to ADP to make ATP. Well, the next intermediate is phosphoenolpyruvate, as you see here. By the way, this is a misspelling. It's spelled correctly earlier in the slideshow, but this should be phosphoenolpyruvate. And that transformation from 2-phosphoglycerate to phosphoenolpyruvate is catalyzed by enolase. Enol is another kind of general word. The all part refers to alcohol. What does ene refer to? A double bond in a hydrocarbon, exactly. So alkanes only have single bonds, right? Alkenes have double bonds between carbons. That's what's happening here. You're making a double bond between 2 carbons in the skeleton. So that's why it's an enol. And that is an unstable intermediate. But by having this phosphoryl group on the oxygen here of this enol in phosphoenolpyruvate, that stabilizes into the enol configuration somewhat. The thing is, it will be a lot more stable if the phosphoryl group gets removed, because then you can eliminate the double bond between the carbons. And that's what happens in this final step, which is the transformation of phosphoenolpyruvate into pyruvate. Notice that the double bond, the ene part, the double bond between carbons, is eliminated. And that's done because the popping off of this phosphoryl group allows this unstable compound to go into the much more stable pyruvate. But that's good in terms of energy payoff, because the phosphoryl group that gets spit off in the process gets picked up by ADP. So you've made another couple ATP, because this is happening twice for each of the two copies. I mean, once for each of the two copies, twice overall. Okay, so that's the end. But slide 14 shows that final reaction here occurring in 2 steps. It's showing you the enol form of pyruvate after it's lost its phosphate. That's the one that I say is highly unstable and will not last. It will immediately get transformed into pyruvate, because that double bond between the carbons does not want to be there, basically. Okay? All right, so that's the final payoff. You end up earning a net 2 ATPs, but you've also produced 2 NADHs in the process. So you've extracted enough energy for more than 2 net ATP, but that's all you have at the moment, and that's all you will have unless you have some way of dealing with the stored energy that's being carried by the reduced coenzymes, NADH. That's what cellular respiration is all about, right? That gives you a way of dealing with that. So in slide 15, we have the very important fork in the road at the end of glycolysis. Glycolysis ends at pyruvate production. And one thing I don't like about this slide is that this implies that there's a trifurcation, that there's 3 possibilities within 1 cell. There isn't. A single cell has 2 possible paths it can go after glycolysis. One of those is to keep oxidizing the fuel until you've completely oxidized it, which means you end up with what? What is completely spent fuel? CO2, carbon dioxide. Doesn't have any more usable energy in terms of oxidation. And so that's why if you go that route that's on the right, which is cellular respiration, then you've extracted as much energy as you possibly can out of that original glucose molecule. Cellular respiration doesn't use glucose. Cellular respiration uses the pyruvate that glycolysis produces. Pyruvate is still that valuable fuel. By the way, what makes respiration respiration, of which there are multiple different versions, is that it involves the pumping of hydrogen ions across a membrane to produce an electrochemical gradient, which can then drive phosphorylation. We'll revisit that all again, but you've heard it before, I'm sure. That's what makes it respiration, that pumping of hydrogen ions through membranes. So respiration by itself doesn't say anything about oxygen. One kind of respiration, though, is using oxygen as the final electron acceptor, which is why that version is aerobic respiration. There is also anaerobic respiration in certain species. They just use something other than oxygen to receive the electrons at the ends of the electron transport chains, but it's still respiration. Okay? Don't say that fermentation is anaerobic respiration. Fermentation is an alternative to respiration. It is not respiration. And therefore, it doesn't produce any additional ATP. Fermentation is being represented on this slide by either of these two left forks, the middle one or the left one. They're just different versions of fermentation. So that's why I said this implies that one cell has three choices here. Depending on the species, a cell has a choice between cellular respiration or its own version of fermentation. There are multiple versions of fermentation. Only two are represented here. There are many more than two kinds of fermentation, but the point is the fork in the road is a choice between fermentation or respiration of some sort. All right? But fermentation does not get you any more ATP. Some books will say fermentation produces ATP. When they say that, which I disagree with, I don't like to think of it that way, what they really mean, what they're calling fermentation, includes glycolysis. Okay? It's glycolysis that produces the ATP. Fermentation is just a pathway after glycolysis that will allow glycolysis to still happen and therefore produce more ATP. But fermentation by itself doesn't produce any ATP. What does fermentation accomplish? Exactly. No matter what kind of fermentation you're talking about, in other words, no matter what the other product of fermentation is, in some species it's ethanol, in some species like us it's lactate, other species something else. Whatever the other product of fermentation is, the whole reason fermentation exists is because of the first product that all fermentations have in common, which is NAD+. Okay, that is what fermentation is doing. If you don't have a respiration mechanism, either because you are a species that just can't do it ever, or because you don't have your final electron acceptor available, which means for aerobes, if there's no oxygen. But for other things, it would be if they don't have their final electron acceptor, then respiration can't happen, right? That's going to shut down respiration. When you shut down respiration, you shut down the ability of the electron transport chains to receive more electrons from the coenzymes that are carrying it from the fuel, specifically NADH, right? When NADH can't dump its electrons onto electron transport chains for respiration, that means it's going to stay as NADH. It's going to stay in the reduced form. You don't really have all that many NAD molecules. You have a finite number, obviously. And they're reusable, right? They keep going back and forth between NAD plus and NADH. So in the taxis analogy, they're either in the full taxi or the empty taxi form. But there's a finite fleet. You have only so many taxis. If every one of them is carrying a passenger, none of them can take on any additional passengers, right? Well, the NAD plus that gets reduced in glycolysis is a necessary player in the game. The reaction won't proceed in terms of the fuel being transformed unless you have NAD plus to receive the electrons that are being stripped from the fuel in glycolysis. So that means if your entire fleet of taxis were already full of passengers, if you only had NADH and no NAD plus, then even though glycolysis does not require oxygen, the absence of oxygen would otherwise shut down glycolysis itself. That's the whole reason you need fermentation. Okay, you need a way to take the electrons back off of NADH that you created in glycolysis so that the NAD plus, the empty taxi, can drive back up to that step that involved the reduction of NAD plus and allow that to happen so that more fuel can be processed. And you have to do that because unless you're processing fuel, you're not making ATP. Okay? In the absence of oxygen, you're not only shutting down the very many ATP molecules that are produced by cellular respiration, but you would shut down the couple that you get for each glucose in glycolysis as well if it weren't for fermentation. So that's why you do this. You don't have to have, cellular respiration accomplishes the same thing. It reoxidizes NADH into NAD+, so it can go back to glycolysis. But it has the advantage of doing, at the same time as reoxidizing NADH into NAD+, using those electrons to produce even more ATP. Okay? Fermentation doesn't do that. It just takes it from the NADH so that you have NAD plus again. And that's why I say that fermentation by itself produces no ATP. It's the glycolysis that produces ATP. All right. Let's look at a couple versions of fermentation. Like I said, there are many different versions depending on species. Most of the alternative versions occur in unicellular organisms. But the reason that almost every textbook that I've ever seen, concentrates on just two of the possible fermentation mechanisms is because they're the two that matter to humans most. One reason is that we as humans perform one of them, so we're interested in it for that reason. That's lactate fermentation. And that's not what we're looking at here. The other is alcohol fermentation. And that's important to us because we use ethanol for various reasons. Not only for beer, wine, and booze, but for other reasons as well. So those are the two that we really care about beyond science for industrial reasons as well. Just keep in mind there are other mechanisms, though. What really is different about them is the final product other than NAD+. But one of those final products, and the one that really matters, is NAD+. And so in alcohol fermentation, which occurs, for instance, in yeast, the pyruvate that is spit out by glycolysis gets transformed into an intermediate, which is acetaldehyde, by an enzyme pyruvate decarboxylase. Now, decarboxylation refers to taking off a carbon and two oxygens. Right? A carboxyl group gets removed. When a carbon and two oxygens are stripped, that means you're actually removing carbon dioxide from the situation, right? So in alcohol fermentation, the pyruvate first gets transformed, pyruvate's a three-carbon compound, it first gets transformed into a two-carbon compound, which is what the acetaldehyde is. And that other carbon, along with two oxygens, leaves in the form of CO2, which is why when you make beer, it naturally gets carbonated. That carbon dioxide gets dissolved in the solution. It's a carbonated beverage. Okay? It's also, though, why if this is happening for the purpose of baking bread, for making, not baking it yet, but making it rise, it does rise because of the CO2 that's liberated. Little gas bubbles in the dough, right? Which is why you can punch it down, you release that gas, and it gets much smaller. Alcohol is produced, but that's retained in beer or wine, the alcohol. When you bake the bread, it's alcohol is volatile, so it just gets removed. That's why you don't get drunk eating bread. But this first step is just, it really isn't the important step in terms of the goal of fermentation. It's just a necessary step because these kind of cells need to work with acetaldehyde rather than pyruvate directly. What really happens in terms of fermentation's importance, though, is the second step when you transform acetaldehyde into ethanol. And the cell is not trying to produce ethanol. I mean, we're trying to get it to produce ethanol for us. But it's not really wanting to produce ethanol. What it wants to happen is the essence of fermentation, which is the NADH that it has, the full taxi, needs to be emptied. It needs to be reoxidized into NAD+. And it does that by dumping that hydrogen that NADH is carrying that was originally from the glucose, dumping it onto this acetaldehyde molecule, which is what makes it into ethanol. So this blue hydrogen here came from NADH. Now that NAD+ can go back up to the step in glycolysis that involves reduction of NAD+ and allow that step to continue, and therefore you can continue breaking down glucose and producing 2 ATP at a time net for every glucose. It's summarized in slide 17, ethanol or alcohol fermentation, in a way that shows you what I just told you in the previous paragraph. The details of the glycolysis, these steps are skipped because what's really important is this step right here, glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate dehydrogenase. That's when the hydrogen is removed from the fuel and put onto the NAD+. That's what fills up the taxis if you don't have the taxis being emptied by respiration. So at the far end, you run fermentation to get it back to NAD+ so that it can go back here and allow this step to continue and therefore allow the rest of glycolysis to continue. All right, in us and other animals, slide 18 now, we do this fermentation step, this fermentation mechanism more directly than yeast or other alcohol fermenters do. We directly put the hydrogen from the fuel back onto pyruvate. So it's still pyruvate, that's the end of glycolysis. But in us, we have an enzyme lactate dehydrogenase that turns pyruvate into lactate by stripping the hydrogen from NADH, in other words, reoxidizing NADH, putting that hydrogen onto the fuel, making it into lactate. This is another example, by the way, of an enzyme that's named for the reverse of the process, right? It's lactate dehydrogenase. If it runs from right to left, what you're doing is taking a hydrogen off of lactate to turn it into pyruvate. That's dehydrogenation. But in the direction that it operates for fermentation, it's actually the opposite, right? You are hydrogenating pyruvate. So we could have named this pyruvate hydrogenase rather than lactate dehydrogenase, but it's just a word game. Okay. 19. Well, this is a similar summary slide that shows you the interaction between fermentation and glycolysis, but this is specifically for lactate fermentation. Still the same situation, though. It's that same step in glycolysis that requires the NAD+. And that's why fermentation is operated so that you have plenty of NAD+, even in the absence of oxygen. In the presence of oxygen, though, you would not want this to occur because this does not get you any additional ATP. And in the presence of oxygen, it automatically won't occur because those pyruvate molecules are going to be continuing to be processed through the cellular respiration pathway. And as long as cellular respiration operates, electron transport chains are continuing to receive electrons from NADHs. That's what accomplishes, alternatively, oxidation of NADH back into NAD+. So you wouldn't have this fermentation pathway happening, which is a good thing for the cell, because if it chooses cellular respiration instead, there's a much bigger payoff in terms of ATP per glucose. Okay, now in 20, what we're looking at is the glycolytic pathway in yellow and blue arrows here. So we've already talked about this. The green boxes, though, notice, are other kinds of sugars. What are galactose and fructose examples of besides sugars? They are also monosaccharides, just like glucose is. And I said glucose is the most prevalent monosaccharide. That's true. But you also have plenty of galactose and fructose monosaccharides in cells because you get them in food. Where do you find galactose? What disaccharide features galactose? What disaccharides, though? Lactose, right. Lactose is a galactose and a glucose. What is table sugar, sucrose? And what else? It's a disaccharide as well. Sucrose is also a disaccharide, like lactose. Yes, glucose and fructose make up sucrose. So you're getting these things in your diet all the time, right? Digestion breaks the disaccharides down into monosaccharides, and then you absorb glucose, galactose, and fructose. Well, glycolysis is always studied in terms of starting at the very beginning with glucose. But there's other fuels that can be fed into the process at different points. You don't have to start at glucose. If you are able to make one of the intermediates of the glycolytic pathway, then that intermediate can enter right at its position, not at the very beginning. And that's what you see happening here. Galactose doesn't have its own pathway, like glycolysis, that starts with galactose. But thankfully, galactose doesn't go to waste because it can be transformed into glucose-6-phosphate, which is that first thing that's formed in the first reaction of glycolysis, right? Once you have glucose-6-phosphate, it doesn't matter where it came from, it can go the rest of the way through glycolysis. And fructose can feed into it at different places, as you see here. Fructose can be phosphorylated into fructose-6-phosphate, which is an intermediate, and therefore it can continue on. Or it can be split into two pieces, each of which gets phosphorylated, and you make the two things that get isomerized. You make glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate and dihydroxyacetone phosphate. Those are also intermediates. So other sugars, and as we'll see, even other nutrients besides sugars, can feed into the glycolytic pathway. In 21, we're seeing this happen in the liver for fructose. So what I just said was it's broken into 2-3 carbon compounds. Fructose is a hexose. It's broken into 2-3 carbon compounds, each of which gets phosphorylated. Well, that's happening right here. First, this is happening in the liver. Fructose first gets phosphorylated into fructose 1-phosphate by an enzyme that's descriptively named fructokinase, right? You're phosphorylating a fructose. That fructose 1-phosphate then gets transformed to, gets split into glyceraldehyde and dihydroxyacetone phosphate. There's only one phosphate on it, right? Fructose 1-phosphate. So when you split it into 2-3 carbons, only one of those three carbons gets the phosphate. That's dihydroxyacetone phosphate, which is one of the glycolytic intermediates. So it can go directly into glycolysis and get isomerized by the enzyme into glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate. It's done, in other words. But the other one is called just glyceraldehyde because it doesn't have the phosphate on it, right? So to make it ready for glycolysis, you also have to phosphorylate it. That's what the liver does with triose kinase. Glyceraldehyde is a triose. It's a 3-carbon sugar. The kinase phosphorylates it and into glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate. So you have both of the things that you would produce from glucose itself, and they can go on to the, well, they both become this version because of the isomerase. And then the energy payoff phase can go on as usual, as though you started off with glucose. Okay, I'm going to stop there so I can give you the take a look at the test.